the kill, and Warner wins the set. Fade away by Moores.
In Play with Craig Maddock, made possible by Horton in Britain, a worldwide supplier of engine cooling systems and proud member of the community for more than four decades. HortonWW.com. Welcome to another edition of In Play. I'm Craig Maddock. Today's guest achieved great success on the track. For decades, it seemed impossible for anybody to run a mile in under 4 minutes. Of course, Roger Bannister changed that in 1954, and American's Jim Ryan was the first high schooler to run a sub-4-minute mile. That was back in 1964. Our guest today broke the 4-minute mile 8 times. He was a 2-time state champ in the mile, had a pretty good career at Indiana University, traveled the world as well, running, but then it almost came to an end. Our guest was training for the 1976 Olympics when he was struck by a hit-and-run driver. Doctors say our guest had a 5% chance of surviving, but he made an astounding recovery from the traumatic brain injury. He's traveled around the country telling his story and encouraging life training techniques. He's also written a book called Running to Win. He's the Watertown Arrow, Steve Heidenreich. Steve, welcome to In Play.
Well, thank you very much, Craig. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on your show. I'm honored to be on your show. And I'll be glad to share my story with you.
Where did the inspiration, though, start for you to run? Where did that come from?
In 1968, the Olympics were in Mexico City, and the Olympic coaches were geniuses. They built a track up by Lake Tahoe for the athletes to train for a year before the Mexico City Olympics. So our athletes trained at altitude, and in that Olympics, the USA team did fantastic. They had 45 gold medals, 28 silver medals, and 34 bronze medals. Whoa, man, they just were fantastic. One of the athletes who won the gold medal in the 400 meters and anchored our 4x400 meter relay team to a world record, Lee Evans, he was coached by Coach Baker. And Coach Baker was one of the coaches at Indiana University.
Uh-huh.
And then Sam Bell coached some sub-4-minute milers at Oregon State. And Oregon State at that time held the world record in the 4x1-mile relay. And so I just thought Indiana was a perfect fit for me. But to get back to why I started, so here I am. I'm a skinny freshman. I weigh about 89 pounds. I watch the Olympics, and I watch Jim Ryan and Marty LaCoury compete well. And, you know, they were defeated by the Kenyan Kino. But, whoa, what an exciting race. And at the age of 15, I decided, okay, I'm going to be on that team. And I'm going to break 4 minutes in a mile. Well, you know,
Your friends, what were they telling you at the time?
Well, you know, they had different thoughts in mind. How are you going to do that? You live in Watertown, South Dakota. We have 3 months of winter. To be an Olympian at that caliber, you got to train twice a day. And Steve, you're slow. Anyway, I said, well, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do whatever it takes. And so as a freshman in high school, I started training twice a day. I did research on the great athletes, Jim Ryan and others. And I saw that the kind of workouts they were doing. And I figured, you know what? If you want to be that good, you got to train twice a day. So I started training twice a day.
By yourself? You didn't have a coach with you? You did it all by yourself?
No, I did, actually. I talked to Coach Godfrey about it.
Okay.
And he agreed. And so what we would do is I would run from my house up to Drake Tietze. Drake Tietze was a great half miler. I'd pick him up. And then we'd pick up Barry Carpenter. Now, Barry Carpenter was the Watertown Arrow quarterback. And then we would run to Coach Godfrey's, and then we'd loop down to my place. So we did this four-mile loop every morning. And then I trained on weekends. You know, I had some success as a freshman. I ran 5:15. As a sophomore, I ran 4:45 in the mile. And then my junior year.
You really exploded your junior year.
I really exploded and ran 4:16 in the mile run in the state meet.
Broke the state record.
And then I knew on that day that, yes, I would break 4 minutes in the mile.
You talked about Coach Godfrey, a great coach for Watertown. What did he mean to you in your early training as a freshman, not knowing exactly where you were going to go?
It was interesting because in my racing, you know, I had a lot of losses. I lost a lot of races. But every time I lost a race, I would learn. I would learn from that loss and how to be better, how to get better the next time. And then I would train to get better. And of course, I would tell Coach Godfrey all the time what I could do better. And he said, after hearing all that, he says, you know, Stephen, I want you talking with your feet. So after that, I didn't talk to him after my losses. I talked with my feet. And I think he left after my sophomore year. He went to the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And it's really my junior year and senior year that I really improved. And I think I surprised him. But, you know, he was a good coach to get started with. He was a very motivational coach.
Yep.
And,
yes, he was.
You know, he really helped the Watertown Arrows. And back in 1970 and 71 and 72, the Arrow track team was pretty darn good. We had a lot of good runners. And what was exciting was the athletes on the team kind of were helping each other. When Drake and I worked out together, you know, we worked out hard and we pushed each other. And that just helped us both get better and better.
Why the mile? I mean, you had the, you know, you had, back at that time, of course, everything was yards. Why not the, you know, the 440 or the 880 yard dash or the 2 mile run? Why did you pick the mile?
I wasn't fast enough. You know, I wasn't fast enough for the 440. Now I could have probably run a pretty good 880. Yeah, I ran 153 on relay teams. On the medley relay and the 2 mile relay, I'd anchor with a 153, and that was good. And I probably could run a good open 800. But the mile was kind of at my niche. You know, at first, my first 2 years in track and field, my freshman, sophomore years, I was really too slow for the mile. In fact, I couldn't make the team for the mile. But then my junior year, my voice changed.
Well,
and I became a man.
And your race changed because you
and
you're
when I
records.
Became a man, all of a sudden I got speed. And I've been doing long distance training my freshman and sophomore year. So when you combine that 2 years of endurance training with all of a sudden getting that speed, yeah, that's what made the difference. So the mile kind of became a natural thing for me.
Sure. Did you play any other sports? Did you play basketball? I know Watertown. I think Watertown made the state tournament like in 71. You know, your senior year, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I got cut my freshman year. I got cut from the basketball team. Yeah, you know what they told me?
Too slow?
That's exactly right. They said, Steve, you're too slow to play basketball.
So as a sophomore, it's 1969, you know, running, what was the running like? As a sophomore, what were you doing to trying to get better at that age?
Well, so at that age, my freshman and sophomore year, I just ran the 2 mile because I think no one else would run it.
And there weren't a lot of volunteers.
I would run the 2 mile, and I did okay. I ran 11 minutes, I think, as a freshman.
Oh.
And I was okay. I wasn't great.
Right.
And it really wasn't until the combination of the 2 years of the distance training and the maturity, my junior year, that it kind of really came together.
Oh, well, the state track meet your junior year was in Rapid City. You won the mile. You broke the state and the class AA record. You ran 4:16.4. You break the record set by Jake Schlicht of Woonsocket back in 1961. You broke the record by 7 seconds. What do you remember about that run, Steve?
Actually, that was a great race. And let me tell you a little bit about that race. So in the conference meet, Jeff Schemmel of Madison, the sophomore sensation, runs 4:17. And Drake Tietze and I finished second and third. We were running about 4:21. And I asked myself, what's the best I can run? 4:16. If I run a perfect race, it'll be a 4:16. And Jeff Schemmel had a press release and said that he was going to break 4:10 in the mile.
Oh boy.
And the state meet. And I looked at that and I said to Drake, you know what? No way he can do that. No way he can go from 4:17 to 4:10 in 1 week. But I think I can run 4:16. So what I did was I visualized the perfect performance. I visualized running that 4:16 with the perfect pace, which would be 64 seconds every lap, with perfect running form, technique, perfect breathing, relaxation, and I would go by the first lap in 64 seconds. Mm. And I visualized Schemmel would be way ahead of me. Way ahead of me. And the next lap at the half mile, 800, 880, I would be 208. He would still be way ahead of me. The third lap, I would run in 64 seconds. He'd start coming back. And the fourth lap, it would look like I was sprinting. But it was actually that Schemmel would be slowing down because he went out too fast. And I visualized that I would pass him at the last 100 meters in the curve and win the state meet in 4:16. So I visualized that performance several times a day, every day before the state meet. Now, you want to know what really happened?
Well, I know that your teammate, Drake Tietze, finished second.
That's right. So here's what happened. The gun went off, and Jeff Schemmel went out unbelievably fast. He went out the first 440 yards in 57 seconds. Yes, he was on world record mile run pace. He was going to beat Jim Ryan's mile run record, and the crowd went crazy because he was 70 yards ahead of Drake Tietze and I. I came by right at 64 seconds. Next lap, he starts slowing down. He comes by in 204, and Drake Tietze and I are at 208. Perfect pace, just like we visualized. The third lap, Schemmel slows down even more. And when I cross the third lap with a 309, I said, he is mine. He's only 30 yards ahead. And in the middle of the first curve, I passed him. And after that, it was like he was walking. Drake Tietze passed him on the back stretch. It looked like I was sprinting the whole last lap, but it was just that everyone else was slowing down. I ran my last lap in 64 seconds, finished the race in 4:16, broke the state record, and was state champion. A visualization is a tool I learned as a junior in high school, and I used that throughout my athletic career in high school and college. It has been very successful, and many other athletes have used it, like Lindsey Vonn. She would go down the slope. She would visualize going down the slope 100 times before she raced.
Jeff Schemmel was a pretty good competitor for you. You guys would race again your senior year. Were you guys friends or were you guys competitors?
We had a good relationship, mm-hmm. But yeah, we were competitive.
Your senior year, 1971, state track meet is in Sioux Falls. You win the mile run again. You don't break your own record, but Jeff Schemmel, there he was right behind you. What was memorable about that race?
Well, that was more of a tactical race. The weather conditions in Sioux Falls on that day were pretty bad. They had, we had that strong west-northwest wind. The wind on the backstretch was just unbelievable. That raced the pack. If you look, I think there's some good pictures in the Sioux Falls paper where at about 330 yards to go, there's a picture of me, Schemmel, Reinhardt, and Drake, and we're all together.
Reinhardt's from Lincoln, right? Jim Reinhardt.
Jim Reinhardt from Lincoln. And at that moment, I decided this race is mine, and I just exploded, and I got a 10-yard lead on Jeff Schemmel, and he couldn't catch up. It was too big of a lead for him. And by the time I got around the curve, the wind was at my back. I think the explosion just kind of separated enough that he couldn't do it. And I had the same tactic, actually, I guess, in Cleveland in 1975 when I raced against the Kenyans. And in that race, I waited patiently for the last 300 meters again, and then I exploded. And get this, I ran my last lap against the Kenyans in 54 seconds.
Wasn't wind aided, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was a calm day. It was perfect conditions, and I had the perfect timing, and I defeated the Kenyans in the mile run with that same kind of strategy.
So your senior year, you're a two-time state champ in the mile. You're getting ready to decide on college. But who was pushing you the most as a runner at that time?
Well, I was recruited by South Dakota State, University of Minnesota, University of Nebraska, LSU, University of Missouri, Indiana University, and Villanova University. So I was heavily recruited. It was an exciting time. I chose Indiana University Sam Bell and Charlie Baker had been Olympic coaches. Sam Bell had coached sub 4 minute milers. So it seemed like a perfect fit. And in the 4 years that I was at Indiana University, we were Big Ten team champions 7 times. So we were Big Ten champions in 1973 in cross country. We were 3 times Big Ten champions in indoor track and 3 times Big Ten team champions in outdoor track. So we just had a really good fit. And, you know, we just kind of helped each other.
When was the first time you ran a sub-4-minute mile?
Well, the first time was my sophomore year. We were at the Penn Relays, and we were running the 4 mile relay, and interesting story. And I got the baton, and we were in 5th place. And I get the baton, and I say to myself, "Okay, I'm going to show these guys. I'm going to show these guys how tough I am. I'm going to run a sub-4-minute mile." So I get the baton, and we're running the last lap. But the thing is, all the anchormen ran sub-4. All the anchormen in that race ran a sub-4 mile, and no one passed anyone. So your team, when they hand it off to you, that was the place your team was going to get. It was an interesting race, and that was my first sub-4-minute mile. Some would say, well, that's not really a sub-4-minute mile because, you know, you had the handoff and you kind of got a running start. But my first one was in 1975. I was racing against Nick Rose, the NCAA champion in cross country in 1975 at Western Kentucky. And he ran a very smart race. He had a teammate go out the first lap in 55 seconds. And on that time, I ran my race. I visualized, I planned running every lap in 60 seconds. So I was way back, 5 seconds back at 60 seconds. Next lap, they ran the fast pace again. And then his teammate dropped off after 2 laps. And it kind of upset me because I was kind of set up. I almost caught him at the end, but he ran a little bit better that day, Nick did, and beat me by about a half second. But that was my first sub-4-minute mile. And I was okay with that because it was exactly like I visualized. You know, I was on pace for every lap, and I did accomplish what I set out to do. And after that, running under 4 became so much easier. It's kind of a head game. Once you know you can do it, it's so much easier.
So 1976, I mean, even prior to 1976, you're seeing a lot of success. Your times are really good. You're probably at your physical peak. You're doing a great job at Indiana University. And now you're training to get on the USA Olympic team. A lot of people thought that you had a great shot at making the Olympics in 1976.
Right. Well, in the summer of 1975 in Prague, Czechoslovakia, I ran the 1500 meters in 3:38. Well, that's equivalent to a 3:55 mile. And at that time, it was the 17th fastest time in the world. And I was about the 4th fastest American. So I had a good shot to make the Olympic team. Everything was going very well for me. That winter indoors, I ran a 4-flat mile indoors. Well, that's a pretty major accomplishment because it's a whole lot harder to run that fast indoors than it is outdoors because of the sharp curves and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was ready. I was really ready. Plus, I was getting a 4.0 GPA. I was really doing well. And then, you know, I had started training twice a day as a freshman in high school. And in high school, I did that my first 2 years in the morning. And then my junior, senior year, I would do it at night after studying. I would go out at 9 o'clock in Watertown and run 4 or 5 miles. And then in college, I would do it at night. So after studying, I went out on my second run wearing my USA uniform, facing traffic. It was kind of a cool evening, starting to snow a little bit, and I'm charging up a hill, and behind me, I hear the roar of an engine, and all of a sudden, it's getting closer and closer. And at the last moment, I try to jump out of the way, but I'm hit from behind. And I fly over the car, and my head slams against the concrete. My skull split. My jaw broke. And I'm left to die. The driver took off. A few moments later, a graduate student stops. He sees the blood gushing out of my head. And all of a sudden, he has a flashback. He's in helicopters going over rice paddies. And he knows what he has to do. He's an EMT in Vietnam. He grabs his winter coat. He rushes to me. He covers me. He waves down the next car and says, go 2 blocks north. Call 911. This soldier has been seriously injured. I'm rushed to the hospital. Dr. Rack, my neurosurgeon, comes in. I grab him by his shirt, and my last words are, help me. Please help me. And then I went out. I went way out. Dr. Rack performed brain surgery, removed part of my skull, tied a bleeding vein in the brain, and removed a blood clot. He listed me as a grade 2 coma, which meant I could only respond to painful stimulus. The skull was fractured into several fragments. Dr. Rack informed my parents, you must understand every case is different, but the odds are not promising that he will survive. With good odds, it'll be touch and go. By good results, I mean doing what he was doing before. People injured like Stephen are rarely, if ever, the same. People who have blood clots on the brain surface are decerebrate and have a low survival rate, probably 5%, even with surgery. And if you operate and have only a 5% survival rate, most patients become vegetative. Rarely do these students recover and do what Stephen was doing. I mean, go on and finish college. We could not expect him to compete again as a runner. So I woke up 2 weeks later, the mental age of a 2-year-old. In a 23-year-old body. And I had to grow up again.
How long did it take?
Once I came to coma, I had physical therapy. And I had to learn how to walk, how to put on my clothes, how to eat. But I left the hospital 1 week later and flew back to Watertown, where my mom quit her job. She was a special ed teaching assistant. You would call them paras today. And she was my mother, teacher, nurse, 24/7. And we would go for walks. And I would point to things. Hey, Mom, what's that? That's a tree. Mom, what's that thing? Moving. That's a car. Mom, what's that red thing? That's the stop sign. And it's not that I didn't know what things were. I knew what things were, but I couldn't find the word. I suffered an aphasia, but my brain started rehealing. And at the same time, you know, this was pretty big news. It was national news. And people were praying for me around the country. And they were praying big. They weren't just praying for me to live. They were praying for a full recovery. So I left the hospital in April. And by May, I'm reading Dick and Jane books. Now, if you don't know, Dick and Jane books are elementary school, first, second grade level books.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And by June, I'm writing. I'm writing letters. And by August, I'm a teenager again. In a 23-year-old body.
Uh-huh.
And it drove my younger sister, Laura, nuts because she was the same age. Except for she was probably more mature than I was. And so I decided to go and, you know, remember when you were 13 and you knew everything? You know, you knew more than your parents. And so I decided, okay, I'm going back to college. So I went back to college to make up my incompletes at the middle age of 13.
What college?
Indiana University.
Okay.
And yeah, I had to make up my incompletes at Indiana University. And after the first week, I realized, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I've got to relearn all this vocabulary. You know, I was taking senior classes at the Indiana University Business School, and I had to learn the vocabulary words for economics, accounting, finance, marketing. I had to learn that business vocabulary. And I realized, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I'm really in trouble. And I called up Dr. Rack. And I told him what the deal was. And he says, well, Stephen, you need to go see Dr. Utz. He's a school psychologist. You go see him. So I go see Dr. Utz, and he gives me a verbal IQ test. Afterwards, he looks me straight in the eye. He says, Stephen, this is going to be hard. You are going to suffer. This is the hardest thing you will ever have to do in your life, but you can do it. And when he said that, I left his office clenching my fist and saying, yes, I'm going to do it. And I took all of the things that I learned to be a world-class athlete, and I applied it to my recovery. And I studied so hard. I would study not just once, not just twice. I would study three times. And the Indiana athletic director gave me access to tutors. After dinner, they had tutors available at one of the dormitories. And so I would go see the tutor for help. Once a week, I would go see my professors during their office hours. And so my F's and D's turned to A's and B's, and I finished that semester after my accident with a 3.7 GPA with permanent brain damage.
When did you start running again and thinking about, I want to maybe do it competitively again?
14 months after the accident, I ran the mile in an all-comers meet and ran the mile in 4:21.
Nice.
And, you know, not bad.
Yeah, not bad.
Not bad.
For what you've been through, right?
Right. You know, when I was in the hospital, I weighed 135 pounds in the hospital, or when I was training, and when I left the hospital, I was just 115 pounds. So I'd lost 20 pounds of muscle mass while recovering. So, yeah, after I ran the mile in 4:20, I decided I would try to, see if I could make the 1980 team. You know, I gave it a good try, gave it a good effort. Unfortunately, you know, our politicians.
We boycotted that. We boycotted that.
Yeah, they decided, and, you know, which was too bad because, you know, I had competed against the Russians and, you know, that's a completely different culture. You know, their athletes are really paid athletes because every one of them is an officer in the military.
Right, right.
I mean, they're pretty darn high-ranking officers in the military.
What was your chance, though, of making that USA team if the U.S.
It was a long shot. It was a long shot. Still, in fact, I never really made the qualifying mark. At that time, to make a qualifying mark, just to even try to qualify, you had to break 4 minutes of the mile. And I just didn't have time.
You know, you decided to take your story across the country. You decided to become a motivational speaker, encouraging traumatic brain injury survivors. When did you start doing that?
Pretty soon after the accident, I started talking to people. I find my story not only for TBI survivors, but just for students in general. You know, if you take the principles, you take the tools that the Olympic coaches taught me on how to be great, and you apply that to the area that you have a passion for, you know, setting high goals, work ethic, visualization, you will become successful. And so that's what I try to teach youth because, you know, I'm kind of a spokesperson for the U.S. Olympic Committee because they like us to talk to youth every year, usually after school's out, and talk to them about what it's like to be on the team and what it takes to make the team. And because, you know, in some sports, you got to start early. You know, I started training about as late as I could possibly start, the age of 15. But if you're in gymnastics, diving, a sport like, you've got to even start earlier. Or you're behind the curve. But we do that to inspire youth to become members the best Olympic team in the world.
Steve, I got two more questions for you.
Okay.
Do you still have any effects? You know, it's been 50 years. Do you still have any effects after the accident?
Yes, I do, but you will never know it. You will never see it. But sometimes it takes me more time to process, to find the right word, to communicate effectively. But the audience will never know it's going on. That's the thing with TBI. It's the disability that people don't see.
Steven, what's keeping you busy today? You moved from Watertown recently.
Yeah, I got married a couple years ago, and I'm living in Wilmer. My wife is a retired physician, and what we're doing now, which is a lot of fun, is we're substitute teaching, and I'm a permanent sub working with special ed students. You know, I was in corporate finance for 17 years. And after that, I decided I'd like to coach. Right? You know, I love that coaching. If I'm going to coach, I need to be in education. And my first sub job was a permanent sub job with a special ed student. He was a fourth grade boy. He had MS. Wheelchair bound, and so they kind of needed a man. He was mentally kind of at first grade level. In one semester, he improved 2 years in reading, writing, and math. And I said to myself, well, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm doing something right. If I can get a boy to improve 2 years in one semester. And so I decided to, so my second career after business was, I was a special ed teacher. And that's what I'm doing now. I've got 11 special ed students right now, and two are wheelchair bound. One is tube fed. Two are nonverbal. And thank goodness I have six paras, because I couldn't do it without them. But that's what I'm doing. I'm a permanent sub for another week at the middle school, and then I go to Roosevelt Elementary School here in Wilmer, and I'll be a permanent sub for another special ed teacher to finish the year. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
Never thought you'd be doing that. Did you?
I didn't. And, you know, it's just kind of surprising. I never knew it. But until I got into it, I didn't realize the gift I had for it. And I think some of the reason I have a gift for it is when I was in college after the accident, I was kind of a special ed student. And so I understand their struggles, because I was struggling at that time. You know what? And I had to work hard. And I tell my students, here's the deal, guys. Life is not fair. You might have to work harder than the average student, but you can still be very successful. And they are. They become successful. And some of them now are managers. One woman owns her own restaurant. But they worked hard. They were willing to work. They used the principles that I was taught. They set themselves high goals. They visualized the perfect performance. They worked very hard. They gave themselves positive reinforcement, and they had patience. And you take all those things and you combine them together, you have a champion.
In Play with Craig Maddock is made possible by Horton in Britain, where smiling at work happens all the time. Apply now at HortonWW.com. If you like what you're hearing, please give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. It helps us gain new listeners. This has been In Play with me, Craig Maddock. This is a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.